Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. It's useful to get some notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. So we've been going through Confessions of an Economic Hitman by John Perkins, a New York Times number one bestseller from 2004. What it does is go into a very deep foundational level for why we're in the kind of debt we are individually, nationally, and globally. So first, let's define this. And this is a quote from John Perkins. Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, and other foreign aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that has taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know. I was an EHM. End quote. Again, that's John Perkins. And I will continue where I left off in the last show from Confessions of an Economic Hitman, which I highly recommend that you read. A major part of Roldos' platform was what came to be known as the hydrocarbons policy. This policy was based on the premise that Ecuador's greatest potential resource was petroleum, and that all future exploitation of that resource should be done in a manner that would bring the greatest benefit to the largest percentage of the population. Roldos was a firm believer in the state's obligation to assist the poor and disenfranchised. He expressed hope that the hydrocarbons policy could, in fact, be used as a vehicle for bringing about social reform. He had to walk a fine line, however, because he knew that in Ecuador, as in so many other countries, he could not be elected without the support of at least some of the most influential families, and that even if he should manage to win without them, he would never see his programs implemented without their support. John was personally relieved that Carter was in the White House during this crucial time. Despite pressures from Texaco and other oil interests, Washington stayed pretty much out of the picture. John knew this would not have been the case under most other administrations, Republican or Democrat. More than any other issue, John believed that it was hydrocarbons policy that convinced Ecuadorians to send Jaime Roldos to the presidential palace in Quito, their first democratically elected president after a long line of dictators. He outlined the basis of this policy in his August 10, 1979 inaugural address. He said, "We must take effective measures to defend the energy resources of the nation. The state must maintain the diversification of its exports and not lose its economic independence. Our decisions will be inspired solely by national interests and in the unrestricted defense of our sovereign rights." And that's the end of that quote. Once in office, Roldos had to focus on Texaco, since By that time, it had become the main player in the oil game. It was an extremely rocky relationship. The oil giant did not trust the new president and did not want to be part of any policy that would set new precedents. It was very aware that such policies might serve as models in other countries. A speech delivered by a key advisor to Roldos, Jose Carvajal, summed up the new administration's attitude. He said, "If a partner, Texaco, does not want to take risks to make investments for exploration or to exploit the areas of an oil concession, the other partner has the right to make those investments and then to take over as the owner. We believe our relations with foreign companies have to be just. We have to be tough in the struggle. We have to be prepared for all kinds of pressures, but we should not display fear or an inferiority complex in negotiating with those foreigners." And that's the end of the quote. On New Year's Day, 1980, John made a resolution. It was the beginning of a new decade. In 28 days, he would turn 35. He resolved that during the next year, he would make a major change in his life, and that in the future, he would try to model himself after modern heroes like Jaime Roldos and Omar Torrijos. In addition, something shocking had happened months earlier. From a profitability standpoint, Bruno had been the most successful president in Maine's history. Nonetheless, suddenly and without warning, Mack Hall had fired him. Mack Hall's firing of Bruno hit Maine like an earthquake. It caused turmoil and dissension throughout the company. Bruno had his share of enemies, but even some of them were dismayed. To many employees, it was obvious that the motive had just been jealousy. During discussions across the lunch table or around the coffee wagon, people often confided that they thought Hall felt threatened by this man who was more than 15 years his junior and who had taken the firm to new levels of profitability. Hall couldn't allow Bruno to go on looking so good, one man said. Hall had to know that it was just a matter of time before Bruno would take over and the old man would be out to pasture. As if to prove such theories, Hall appointed Paul Priddy as the new president. Paul had been a vice president at Maine for years and was an amiable nuts and bolts engineer. In John's opinion, he was also lackluster, a yes man who would bow to the chairman's whims and would never threaten him with stellar profits. John's opinion was shared by many others. For John, Bruno's departure was devastating. He had been a personal mentor and a key factor in their international work. Priddy, on the other hand, had focused on domestic jobs and knew little, if anything, about the true nature of their overseas roles. John had to question where the company would go from here. John called Bruno at his home and found him philosophical. "Well, John, he knew he had no cause," he said of Hall. "So I demanded a very good severance package, and I got it. Mac controls a huge block of voting stock, and once he made his move, there was nothing I could do." Bruno indicated that he was considering several offers of high-level positions at multinational banks that had been their clients. John asked him what he thought John should do. "Keep your eyes open," he advised. "Mack Hall has lost touch with reality, but no one will tell him so, especially not now, after what he did to me." In late March of 1980, still smarting from the firing, John took a sailing vacation in the Virgin Islands. He was joined by Mary, a young woman who also worked for Maine. Although John did not think about it when he chose the location, he now knows that the region's history was a factor in helping him make a decision that would start to fulfill his New Year's resolution. The first inkling occurred early one afternoon as they rounded St. John's Island and tacked into Sir Francis Drake Channel, which separates the American from the British Virgin Islands. and I'll come back to this after a station identification. This is Iowa Bankruptcy Attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. The channel was named, of course, after the English scourge of the Spanish gold fleets. That fact reminded John of the many times during the past decade when he had thought about pirates and other historical figures, men like Drake and Sir Henry Morgan, who robbed and plundered and exploited, and yet were lauded, even knighted, for their activities. John had often asked himself why, given that he had been raised to respect such people, he should have qualms about exploiting countries like Indonesia, Panama, Colombia, and Ecuador. So many of his heroes, Ethan Allen, Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, Lewis and Clark, to name just a few, had exploited Indians, slaves, and lands that did not belong to them. And John had drawn upon their examples to assuage his guilt. Now, tacking up Sir Francis Drake Channel, he saw the folly of his past rationalizations. John remembered some things he had conveniently ignored over the years. Ethan Allen spent several months in fetid and cramped British prison ships, much of the time locked into 30 pounds of iron shackles, and then more time in an English dungeon. He was a prisoner of war, captured at the 1775 Battle of Montreal, while fighting for the same source of freedom Jaime Roldos and Omar Torrijos now sought for their people. Thomas Jefferson, George Washington, and all the other founding fathers had risked their lives for similar ideals. Winning the revolution was no foregone conclusion. They understood that if they lost, they would be hanged as traitors. Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, and Lewis and Clark also had endured great hardships and made many sacrifices. And Drake and Morgan? John was a bit hazy about that period in history, but he remembered that Protestant England had seen itself sorely threatened by Catholic Spain. He had to admit to the possibility that Drake and Morgan had turned to piracy in order to strike at the heart of the Spanish Empire, at those gold ships, to defend the sanctity of England, rather than out of a desire for self-aggrandizement. As they sailed up that channel, tacking back and forth into the wind, inching closer to the mountains rising from the sea, Great Thatch Island to the north and St. John to the south, John could not erase these thoughts from his mind. Mary handed him a beer and turned up the volume on a Jimmy Buffett song. Yet, despite the beauty that surrounded him and the sense of freedom that sailing usually brings, he felt angry. John tried to brush it off. He chugged down the beer. The emotion would not leave. John was angered by those voices from history and the way he had used them to rationalize his own greed. He was furious at his parents and at Tilton, that self-righteous prep school on the hill, for imposing all that history on him. John popped open another beer. He could have killed Mac Hall for what he had done to Bruno. A wooden boat with a rainbow flag sailed past them, its sails billowing out on both sides, downwinding through the channel. A half dozen young men and women shouted and waved at them, hippies in brightly colored sarongs, one couple stark naked on the foredeck. It was obvious from the boat itself and the look about them that they lived aboard a communal society, modern pirates, free, uninhibited. John tried to wave back, but his hand would not obey. He felt overcome with jealousy. Mary stood on the deck, watching them as they faded into the distance at their stern. "How would you like that life?" she asked. And then John understood. It was not about his parents, Tilton or Mac Hall. It was about his life he hated. His, the person responsible, the one he loathed, was himself. Mary shouted something. She was pointing over the starboard bow. She stepped closer to him. Leinster Bay, she said, tonight's anchorage. There it was, nestled into St. John Island, a cove where pirate ships had lain in wait for the gold fleet when it passed through this very body of water. John sailed in closer, then handed the tiller over to Mary and headed up to the foredeck. As she navigated the boat around the watermelon quay and into the beautiful bay, John lowered and bagged the jib and hauled the anchor out of its locker. She deftly dropped the mainsail. John nudged the anchor over the side. The chain rattled down into the crystal clear water, and the boat drifted to a stop. After they settled in, Mary took a swim and a nap. He left her a note and rowed the dinghy ashore, beaching it just below the ruins of an old sugar plantation. John sat there next to the water for a long time, trying not to think, concentrating on emptying himself of all emotion, but it did not work. Late in the afternoon, John struggled up the steep hill and found himself standing on the crumbling walls of this ancient plantation, looking down at their anchored sloop. John watched the sun sink toward the Caribbean. It all seemed very idyllic, yet he knew that the plantation surrounding him had been the scene of untold misery. Hundreds of African slaves had died here, forced at gunpoint to build the stately mansion, to plant and harvest the cane, and to operate the equipment that turned raw sugar into the basic ingredient of rum. The tranquility of the place masked its history of brutality, even as it masked the rage that surged within him. The sun disappeared behind a mountain-ridged island. A vast magenta arch spread across the sky. The sea began to darken, and John came face to face with the shocking fact that he, too, had been a slaver, that his job at Maine had not been just about using debt to draw poor countries into the global empire. His inflated forecasts were not merely vehicles for assuring that when his country needed oil, they could call in their pound of flesh, and his position as a partner was not simply about enhancing the firm's profitability. His job was also about people and their families, people akin to the ones who had died to construct the wall he sat on, people he had exploited. For 10 years, John had been the heir of those slavers who had marched into African jungles and hauled men and women off to waiting ships. His had been a more modern approach, subtler. John never had to see the dying bodies, smell the rotting flesh, or hear the screams of agony. But what he had done was every bit as sinister, and because he could remove himself from it, because John could cut himself off from the personal aspects, the bodies, the flesh, and the screams, perhaps in the final analysis, he was the greater sinner. And I'll return after a station identification. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you are listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. John glanced at the sloop where it rode an anchor, straining against the outflowing tide. Mary was lounging on the deck, probably drinking a margarita and waiting to hand one to him. In that moment, seeing her there in that last light of the day, so relaxed, so trusting, John was struck by what he was doing to her and to all others who worked for him, the ways he was turning them into EHMs, economic hitmen. John was doing to them what Claudine had done to him, but without Claudine's honesty. John was seducing them through raises and promotions to be slavers, and yet they, like him, were also being shackled to the system. They, too, were enslaved. John turned away from the sea and the bay and the magenta sky. He closed his eyes to the walls that had been built by slaves torn from their African homes. He tried to shut it all out. When he opened his eyes, he was staring at a large, gnarled stick as thick as a baseball bat and twice as long. He leaped up, grabbed the stick, and began slamming it against the stone walls. John beat on those walls until he collapsed from exhaustion. He lay in the grass after that, watching the clouds drift over him. Eventually, he made his way back down to the dinghy. He stood there on the beach, looking out at their sailboat anchored in the azure waters, and he knew what he had to do. He knew that if he ever went back to his former life, to Maine and all it represented, he would be lost forever. The raises, the pensions, the insurance, and the perks, the equity. The longer he stayed, the more difficult it was to get out. He had become a slave. He could continue to beat himself up as he had beat on those stone walls, or he would escape. 2 days later, he returned to Boston. On April 1st, 1980, he walked into Paul Priddy's office and resigned. Leaving Maine was no easy matter. Paul Priddy refused to believe John. "April fools," he winked. John assured him that he was serious. Recalling Paula's advice that he should do nothing to antagonize anyone or to give cause for suspicion that he might expose his EHM work, John emphasized that he appreciated everything Maine had done for him, but that he needed to move on. He had always wanted to write about the people that Maine had introduced him to around the world, but nothing political. He said he wanted to freelance for National Geographic and other magazines, and to continue to travel. He declared his loyalty to Maine and swore that he would sing its praises at every opportunity. Finally, Paul gave in. After that, everyone else tried to talk him out of resigning. He was reminded frequently about how good he had it, and he was even accused of insanity. He came to understand that no one wanted to accept the fact that he was leaving voluntarily, at least in part because it forced them to look at themselves. If he were not crazy for leaving, then they might have to consider their own sanity in staying. It was easier to see him as a person who had departed from his senses. Particularly disturbing were the reactions of his staff. In their eyes, he was deserting them, and there was no strong heir apparent. However, he had made up his mind. After all those years of vacillation, John now was determined to make a clean sweep. Unfortunately, it did not quite work out that way. True, he no longer had a job, but since he had been far from a fully vested partner, the cash out of his stock was not sufficient for retirement. Had he stayed at Maine another few years, he might have become the 40-year-old millionaire he had once envisioned. However, at 35, he had a long way to go to accomplish that objective. It was a cold and dreary April in Boston. Then one day, Paul Priddy called and pleaded with him to come to his office. "One of our clients is threatening to drop us," he said. "They hired us because they wanted you to represent them on the expert witness stand." John thought a lot about it. By the time he sat across the desk from Paul, he had made his decision. He named his price, a retainer that was more than 3 times what his main salary had been. To his surprise, Paul agreed, and that started John on a new career. For the next several years, he was employed as a highly paid expert witness, primarily for U.S. electric utility companies seeking to have new power plants approved for construction by public utility commissions. One of his clients was the Public Service Company of New Hampshire. His job was to justify, under oath, the economic feasibility of the highly controversial Seabrook nuclear power plant. Although John was no longer directly involved with Latin America, he continued to follow events there. As an expert witness, he had lots of time between appearances on the stand. He kept in touch with Paula and renewed old friendships from his Peace Corps days in Ecuador, a country that had suddenly jumped to center stage in the world of international oil politics. Jaime Roldós was moving forward. He took his campaign promises seriously and was launching an all-out attack on the oil companies. He seemed to see clearly the things that many others on both sides of the Panama Canal either missed or chose to ignore. He understood that underlying currents that threatened to turn the world into a global empire and to relegate the citizens of his country to a very minor role, bordering on servitude. As John read the newspaper articles about him, he was impressed not only by Roldós' commitment, but also by his ability to perceive the deeper issues. And the deeper issues pointed to the fact that they were entering a new epoch of world politics. In November of 1980, Carter lost the U.S. presidential election to Ronald Reagan. The Panama Canal Treaty he had negotiated with Torrijos and the situation in Iran, especially the hostages held at the U.S. Embassy and the failed rescue attempt, were major factors. However, something subtler was also happening. A president whose greatest goal was world peace and who was dedicated to reducing U.S. dependence on oil was replaced by a man who believed that the United States' rightful place was at the top of a world pyramid held up by military muscle, and that controlling oil fields wherever they existed was part of the country's manifest destiny. A president who installed solar panels on White House roofs was replaced by one who, immediately upon occupying the Oval Office, had them removed. Carter may have been an ineffective politician, but he had a vision for America that was consistent with the one defined in the U.S. Declaration of Independence. In retrospect, he now seems naively archaic, a throwback to the ideals that molded this nation and drew so many of the grandparents to her shores. When Carter was compared to his immediate predecessors and successors, he is an anomaly. His worldview was inconsistent with that of the EHMs. Reagan, on the other hand, was most definitely a global empire builder, a servant of the corporatocracy. At the time of his election, John found it fitting that he was a Hollywood actor, a man who had followed orders passed down from moguls who knew how to take direction. That would be his signature. He would cater to the men who shuttled back and forth from corporate CEO offices to bank boards and into the halls of government. He would serve the men who appeared to serve him, but who in fact ran the government. Men like Vice President George H.W. Bush, Secretary of State George Shultz, Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, Richard Cheney, Richard Helms, and Robert McNamara. He would advocate what those men wanted, an America that controlled the world and all its resources, a world that answered to the commands of that America, a U.S. military that would enforce the rules as they were written by America, and an international trade and banking system that supported America as CEO of the global empire. As John looked into the future, it seemed they were entering a period that would be very good to the EHMs. It was another twist of fate that John had chosen this moment in history to drop out. The more he reflected on it, however, the better he felt about it. He knew that his timing was right. And we will continue the Confessions of an Economic Hitman story in the next show. This is Iowa bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.